America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
Well, George talks to the nation. It's George W. Bush.
We're not going to raise gas taxes to pay for bridge repairs. That, after all, would be a tax hike. We can't have tax hikes, you know. We can't have millionaires and billionaires or anybody paying for the infrastructure that they use. We just have to borrow more money and have our children and grandchildren pay for it. Don't you know? It's the Reagan way. It's the Bush way. Ronald Reagan ran up more debt in his 8 years in office than every other president of the United States from George Washington to Ronald Reagan combined. And Bush says, well, you know, so we're borrowing trillions of dollars. So our, you know, when Bush came into office, when Reagan came into office, our national debt was around $1 trillion. When he left, it was around $4 trillion. Bush comes into office, our national debt's around $5 trillion. Now it's around $9 trillion, and they're going to bump up against the debt ceiling probably in the mid-October, and Congress is going to have to raise it yet again. But we're not going to pay taxes. No siree, Bob. It's, after all, it's the Republican way. You don't pay as you go. In fact, remember Bush ridiculing PAYGO during the debates with Kerry? He said, oh, no, I don't want to PAYGO. It's PAYGO's nonsense. Yeah, the whole idea of going into a store and paying for something when you actually buy it, that's nonsense. You should go into the store and borrow the money for it.
That's incredible. The New York Times reporting the Democratic chairman of the House Transportation Committee proposed a 5-cent increase in the 18.3 cent a gallon federal gas tax to establish a new trust fund for repairing or replacing structurally deficient highway bridges. Gee, rocket science. See, the problem with the federal gas tax is that it is a fixed amount rather than a fixed percentage. So it doesn't increase with inflation. As the value of the dollar goes down, the revenue goes down. It's real simple. And then another issue, and perhaps an even larger one, if you can think of a larger issue than, you know, 16,000-18,000 bridges that are about to fail around the United States, is the fact that homeowners are going down in flames, in large part because of the Bush mania for deregulation, really the Reagan mania for deregulation. It started with Reagan. Greenspan pumped it. In fact, it's interesting. 5 years ago, Greenspan gave a speech in which he said that it would be difficult to foresee the consequences of the way that the banking industry, I'm paraphrasing now, of the way that the banking industry was loosening up the requirements for getting credit. Difficult to foresee the consequences. Well, the consequences are that you've got all these loans out there from people who literally walked in and said, and were handed a piece of paper, the loan officer said, fill out this piece of paper and write down how much you make, and by the way, nobody's going to check on it. And so they, you know, somebody who's making $9,000 a year as a greeter at Walmart fills it out and says, I work at IBM, I'm making $125,000. Cool! Here you go, we'll give you $250,000 to buy a home. And just don't notice that fine print, by the way, down at the bottom that says that your monthly payments right now are $1,200 a month, but 2 years from now, they're going to be $2,500 a month. That ARM, it doesn't mean adjustable rate mortgage. That means this mortgage is strong like an arm that lifts weights. That's what it means. And now it's catching up with people. The economy is not good. Working people are being screwed in the United States. They can't pay their home mortgages. And these shaky mortgages got bundled together as securities, which, by the way, is a practice that goes all the way back to the late 30s. When Fannie Mae was first started, it was started as a way of diminishing the risk of individual banks by bundling the loans and then reselling them as securities, and or actually government guaranteeing them initially, so that any individual bank wouldn't get totally wiped out if there was an economic downturn and a lot of loans went south. And then the Veterans Administration came in the 1940s, the late 1940s after World War II and the early 1950s, and added another layer of insurance to lenders And then Freddie Mac came along in the 70s and added another layer of insurance to lenders. And each one, with the exception of the VA, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, what they've done now, as Bush is trying to push them entirely private, they're now kind of semi-private, largely private agencies. They originally were largely government agencies. And they weren't pure government agencies. They were independent corporations. But one of those odd things, because the word corporation doesn't exist in the Constitution. So creating a corporation, a federal corporation, literally requires an act of Congress. Whereas if you want to create a California corporation, all you do is you walk into any office of Secretary of State and say, I'd like to register my corporation here in California or Delaware or Connecticut or New Jersey or New York or whatever. So anyhow, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac bundling all these loans together and reselling them out there. And right now in the news from France, I mean, France? Say what? I mean, this is happening all over the country. Companies and banks, and in some cases national banks, that had bought what they thought were high-yield securities. Hey, you know, there was good return on investment. Why? Because they're risky. They bought these high-yield securities, and now Americans are defaulting. The securities are just bundled home loans. People are not paying back their loans. The value of these things has fallen apart. Bear Stearns' hedge funds was just the tip of the iceberg. So the stock market down 138 points right now, in large part because a French bank has said, we're not going to do this anymore. So they say to Bush today in the press conference, what are you going to do about this? Should we bail out the individual homeowner? Should we backstop them? The people who are being thrown out of their homes, who are out of the... Oh, no, says Bush. Those are the little people. You only bail out bankers when they're like his brother, you know, Neil, with Silverado Savings and Loan. So Greenspan couldn't see the consequences of it. I think probably anybody with any common sense could have, but Greenspan doesn't fall into that category. He spent too much time reading Milton Friedman. But there's a larger issue, frankly, and I was surprised that it didn't... Well, I guess I wasn't surprised, given the docility of the press corps, that Bush was not pressed on this. And this is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. The reinvention of it. And, we've gotten so many calls. There's so many people who are so concerned about this. And I know Congress, particularly those 16 members of the Senate and the 41 members of the House, Democratic members of the Senate and House, who voted along with virtually all the Republicans to amend the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, not just to make it possible, not just to fill in some of the holes, because there were some holes that needed to be filled in. I mean, this act was originally passed back in 1978, and it didn't envision things like instant messenger. I mean, here's the problem that we have right now. Then the head of the NSA came out and said, yeah, here's the problem. If somebody in Pakistan and somebody in England are talking to each other using an AOL account with AOL Instant Messenger, that's routed through AOL servers in the United States, for example. I mean, this wasn't the example that was given by the head of the NSA. This is one that I'm, you know, just as a for example, you know, pulling out of the air here. But I think it's probably a valid one. If the servers happen to be in the United States, then under the FISA Act, it makes it a little more problematic. So they're saying, you know, we need to pick some holes with this thing. The problem that nobody is talking about has to do with signing statements and vetoes. Dianne Feinstein, who is not, I don't, you know, I really don't think that she's a turncoat or anything like that on this issue. I really think that we've got a couple of members, particularly the members of the Intelligence Committee, like Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Mikulski, who were just buffaloed on this thing. Dianne Feinstein saying, now this is a temporary bill. It's to fill a gap. This was her floor speech. The court has done something which said that what has existed for decades with respect to the collection of foreign intelligence now cannot exist under the present law, and we need to change that law. See, she's right about that. And then she says she's going to vote for both bills, for the original Democratic bill, which just fixed it, and for the Republican bill, which gives Bush basically amnesty for all the crimes he's committed. I mean, it doesn't literally, but the effect will be there. And I'll explain to you exactly why, what I think the consequences of this are going to be right after the break, 16 minutes past the hour.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Vietnam vet with a cardboard sign, sitting there by the left turn line. Flag on a wheelchair flapping in the breeze, one leg missing and both hands free. No one's paying much mind to him, the VA budget's just stretched so thin, and there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore.
21 minutes past the hour. At the same, by the way, let me just add two quick things here before I get into this screed about the FISA Act. The first is that yesterday, it was either yesterday or the day before, the New York Times, Wednesday, yesterday's New York Times, Michael Gordon, an article in which he said that attacks on American forces are the consequence of, quoting from his article, a lethal type of roadside bomb said to be supplied by Iran, end quote. Now, the said-to-be was from one single military source, or at least primarily a single military source, who he doesn't name and who he doesn't challenge. And he says, anybody who doesn't agree with us that Iran is supplying these roadside bombs, they're critics of Bush. I mean, this is Judy Miller all over again in the New York Times, on the front page of the New York Times. And today, Bush recycled it. See, this is how it works. They pump this stuff up to the point where they can get it into some mainstream media outlet, some little half truth or quarter truth or a little shred of truth. But and then once it's in the mainstream media, Bush takes that fragment of a sentence and turns it into a whole huge talking point about, you know, well, what about the fact that al-Maliki is in Iran right now talking to the Iranians? You know, the prime minister of Iraq. Well, you know, we hope that he's going to kick their butts just like we are. Iran is a destabilizing influence in the Middle East, don't you know? And therefore, maybe we should nuke them. But no, he didn't say that. This is how it happened in 2002. Which brings me back to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. The FISA Act. Dianne Feinstein. She says, it's my intention to vote for both bills. The reason I vote for both bills is to see that some bill gets the required 60 votes to get passed tonight. We're going out of session. There's no time. I think this is unfortunate. I received the Democratic bill about 20 minutes ago, went into the leader's office, tried to sit down and get briefed. Up to this point, I still don't understand it. Now, this is her speech in favor of voting for this thing. I spent all afternoon, she says, on the McConnell bill, that's the Republican one, and I'm just beginning to understand the subtleties in it and other laws that come into play. So this is not going to be an easy vote, I think, for anyone, but what we have to think of right now is on a temporary basis, how do we best protect the people of the United States against a terrible attack? I yield the chair. I thank the chair. I yield the floor. That was Dianne Feinstein. And Barbara, and I'm not saying this in a condemnatory fashion. I'm not condemning her for saying this. I'm just laying out what happened. Barbara Mikulski, see, these are both members of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Their opinions had a lot of weight with a lot of other senators. Barbara Mikulski, she says, we have two proposals tonight. The Rockefeller Levin proposal is the most desirable. That was the Democratic one that actually fixed the holes that everybody agreed should have been fixed in FISA. She says, while the McConnell proposal is also acceptable. That's the one that basically makes legal some of the things that Bush has been doing that previously were illegal. Here's the problem. If Feingold's censure resolution goes forward, let's censure the president for spying on people illegally. Well, now it's legal. If Dennis Kucinich's impeachment resolution, well, he's trying to impeach Cheney, but this, it's part of it. if anybody were to try to put forth any sort of an impeachment resolution, or for that matter, criminal prosecution after the fact, let's hold this guy accountable. He broke a law that says that anybody who, any federal official who breaks this law, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, any official who breaks this law must spend 2 years in jail every time they did it. And he bragged about some 15,000 violations. Plus pay a huge fine. So here's where it gets. This is the real downside of this, frankly, in my mind. Because, I mean, you go back to the relatively tame but nonetheless cutting into our civil liberties legislation that was passed when Bill Clinton was president. After the first major terrorist act inside the United States, religiously motivated terrorist attack, Christian Timothy McVeigh blowing up the federal building in Oklahoma City in order to bring about the end of the world. And Bill Clinton passed this legislation, and there was broad consensus that this thing is flawed, but we'll fix it later. Don't worry. It never got fixed. And now you've got 16 Democratic senators and 41 Democrats in the House of Representatives who joined all the Republicans. The Republicans weren't saying, we'll fix it later. They're just signed on gung-ho for fascism in America. Give the president the power of a king. But at least the Democrats who had some common sense were saying, you know, Bush, I mean, this was a game of chicken, and Bush didn't blink, and the Democrats did, frankly. And the Democrats are saying, well, you know, we'll fix this thing later. Here's the problem. Let me just make this very, very clear to any Democratic members of the House or Senate who may be listening. Here's the problem. When you fix it later, Bush will attach a signing statement to your fix that negates it, or he will veto your fix later. That's the danger of passing legislation of any kind, frankly, while this guy is president. And that's why this was such a horrible mistake. And a mistake that I really truly believe was done, at least by the Democrats, with the very best of intentions, wanting to protect this country. But man, what a mistake. I mean, the history will look back on this with a shudder. In fact, I want to tell you a little bit about the history in another context in just a second. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
What happened here was the gradual habituation of the people, little by little, to being governed by surprise, to receiving decisions deliberated in secret, to believing that the situation was so complicated that the government had to act on information which the people could not understand, or so dangerous that even if the people could understand it, it couldn't be released because of national security. This is a quote from Milton Mayer's book. Milton Mayer was an American writer out of Chicago who, after World War II, in the late 1940s, went over to Germany and spent about a year over there doing absolutely extraordinary in-depth interviews with 10 average Germans who, just average Germans, not people who'd been in the military, not people who'd been high up in the Nazi Party, but who all had joined the Nazi Party. There was a college professor, there was a baker, there was a guy who worked in a factory. And his question was, how could you guys have done this? How could you have done this? The college professor that he interviewed was the guy who gave the quote that I just shared with you. He said, this separation of government from people, this widening of the gap, took place so gradually and so insensibly, each step disguised, perhaps not even intentionally, as a temporary emergency measure or associated with true patriotic allegiance or with some real social purposes, in all the crises and all the reforms, and there were real reforms, so occupied the people that they did not see the slow motion underneath of the whole process of government growing remoter and remoter. He said to Milton Mayer, he said, to live in this process, he said, you have to understand, to live in this process is absolutely not to be able to notice it. Please try to believe me, unless one has a much greater degree of political awareness, acuity, than most of us ever had occasion to develop. Each step was so small, so inconsequential, so well explained or on occasion regretted, that unless one were detached from the whole process from the beginning, unless one understood what the whole thing was in principle, what all these little measures that no patriotic German could resent must someday lead to, one no more saw it developing from day to day than a farmer in his field sees the corn growing. One day, it is over his head. Pastor Niemöller, the guy who said, you know, first they came for the communists and I was not a communist, and then they came for the socialists and I was not, et cetera, et cetera. And then finally they came for me and I was... Pastor Niemöller, again, this is a Christian who had joined the Nazi Party, who was a professor in a university in Germany and just worked as a professor throughout the war. He said, Pastor Niemöller spoke for the thousands and thousands of men like me when he spoke too modestly of himself and said that when the Nazis attacked the communists, he was a little uneasy, but after all, he was not a communist, so he did nothing. And then they attacked the socialists, and he was a little uneasier, but still he was not a socialist, and he did nothing. And then the schools, the press, the Jews, and so on, and he was always uneasier, but still he did nothing. And then they attacked the church, and he was a churchman, and he did something, but then it was too late. You see, one doesn't see exactly where or how to move. Believe me, this is true. Each act, each occasion is worse than the last, but only a little worse. You wait for the next and the next. You wait for the one great shocking occasion, thinking that others, when such a shock comes, will join you in resisting somehow. You don't want to act or even to talk alone. You don't want to go out of your way to make trouble. Why not? Well, you're not in the habit of doing it. It's not just fear of standing alone that restrains you. It's also genuine uncertainty. Uncertainty is a very important factor. And instead of decreasing as time goes on, it grows. Outside in the streets, in the general community, it seems everyone's happy. One hears no protests, certainly sees none. You know, in France or Italy, there's slogans against the government painted on walls and fences. But here in Germany, outside the great cities, perhaps, not even this. In the university community, in my own community, I speak privately to my colleagues, some of whom certainly feel as I do. But what do they say? They say, it's not so bad. You're seeing things. You're an alarmist. And you are an alarmist. You're saying that this must lead to that, but you can't prove it. These are the beginnings, yes, but how do you know for sure when you don't know the end? And how do you know or even surmise the end? On the one hand, your enemies, the law, the regime, the party intimidate you. On the other, your colleagues poo-poo you as pessimistic or even neurotic. And that one great shocking occasion when tens or hundreds of thousands will join with you in the streets never comes. That's the difficulty. If the last and worst act of the whole regime had come immediately after the first and the smallest, thousands, yes, millions would have been sufficiently shocked. If, let us say, the gassing of the Jews in 43 had come immediately after the German firm stickers in the windows of non-Jewish shops in 33. But, of course, this isn't the way it happens. In between come all the hundreds of little steps, some of them imperceptible, each of them preparing you not to be shocked by the next. Step C is not so much worse than step B, and if you didn't make a stand at B, why should you make a stand at C, and so on to step D, and one day, too late. This college professor who had lived through the Nazi era in Germany as a good German, talking to Milton Mayer for his book, They Thought They Were Free. In 1949, he says, and one day too late, your principles, if you were ever sensible of them, all rush in upon you. The burden of self-deception has grown too heavy, and some minor incident, in my case, my own little boy, hardly more than a baby, saying, Jews, swine, collapses it all at once. And you see that everything has changed, and changed completely under your nose. The world you live in, your nation, your people, it's not the world you were in at all. The forms are all there. They're all untouched. It's all very reassuring. The houses, the shops, the jobs, the mealtimes, the visits, the concerts, the cinema, the holidays. But the spirit, which you never noticed because you made the lifelong mistake of identifying it with the forms, is changed. Now you live in a world of hate and fear. And the people who hate and fear do not even know it themselves. When everyone is transformed, no one is transformed. Now you live in a system which rules without responsibility, even to God. And I'm just concerned that the FISA Act is that, remember he was talking about from step A to B and B to C, each step, it's another one of those little steps. And I hope, I certainly have let my elected representatives know that I hope that when they come back from this congressional recess, the very first thing they do is once again make what George Bush was doing and apparently is doing illegal with regard to spying on all the rest of us. And they investigate the spying that was done, frankly, on them. I mean, why has nobody launched an investigation into Orrin Hatch's assistant who tapped into Ted Kennedy's computer for over a year when they were debating the nomination of Scalia? The Democrats kept getting whipsawed. You know, how did the Republicans know that this was our strategy? Well, it's because the Republicans were reading Ted Kennedy's email. And Orrin Hatch admitted this. He fired the guy. Nobody's ever investigated it. So anyhow, a lot on the table here today. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Larry in Middletown, New York. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I also share your frustration. It seems like, once again, the Democrats really just let the president set the agenda, and they're just on defense rather than offense.
Well, Larry, we got to be really careful with that kind of language, because it's the language that the Republicans and particularly the mainstream media are putting out. It's not the Democrats. It was a small minority of Democrats. The vast majority of Democrats voted against this. The vast majority of Democrats stood up against this.
Okay, that's fair enough. There is an interesting parallel I thought about when you said earlier about things now being legal that were illegal. There's a young man currently in jail in Georgia. You may be familiar with his case. He had consensual sex with his girlfriend.
Right, and he was like 18 and she was 16 or something like that?
Yeah, 17 and 15. But the point is, they actually passed a law in Georgia where that behavior is no longer illegal, yet he remains in jail. They never made his penalty retroactive. I'm curious then, Bush had broken the law. It's now apparently not illegal what he's doing, but is it retroactive or can he still be held accountable?
I don't know. I believe you cannot pass ex post facto laws. You can't pass laws that reach back into the past. But, you know, the kid in Georgia certainly should have been pardoned. I mean, you know, there's some rationality. But with regard to whether Bush's immunity under FISA is retroactive, I just don't know, Larry. It's a good question to put to a constitutional scholar, and the next time we get one on, I'll ask it. But Richard in North Bergen, New Jersey, in fact, has some thoughts on this. You say it's not retroactive, Richard?
I was just asking about that also, if it's retroactive. I understand it can't be, but as you pointed out, also, too, if they're going to revisit it in 6 months, that's going to be right in the middle of a campaign.
Right.
No Democrat is going to want to be accused of being light on terror.
Well, this is why, you know, my point is that this is a piece of legislation that did not come out of the intelligence community. It came out of Karl Rove's office, in my opinion, and that this is part of the Republican political strategy for 2008 and all the more the tragedy. And you know, Karl Rove trying to have his 100 years of Republican rule, his single party state. He's come out and said it. I mean, he's just openly said it. We want to have 100 years of Republicans running this country. That's called a one party state. You know, the Soviet Union, they was the Politburo. Well, it was the Communist Party, actually. It's in Nazi Germany, it was the Nazi Party. It was the fascists in Franco's Spain and Mussolini's Italy. Is that what we want? I don't think so. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Indeed it is. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com, our accredited White House and congressional correspondents. So we get into all the little secret nooks and crannies of Washington, D.C. that most of us don't have access to. Hey, Ellen.
Well, there's not a whole lot going on that everybody doesn't have access to today, but before I get to the presidential press conference, the insanity of the election. The original New Hampshire primary was supposed to be January 22nd. South Carolina pushed up the primary to January 19th at a news conference. The Secretary of State in New Hampshire will set it, as will be the Iowa primary beforehand. It will go, it may go as early as late as January 12th and may even go into December for all we know.
Wow.
I mean, this is nuts.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, you consider in the United Kingdom, typically an election lasts three to four weeks at the very most. And in fact, in most countries in the world, you know, the election cycle is just a matter of a few months at the very most.
So be prepared to come up to New Hampshire a little early for our
for the radio row.
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe it'll even be warm. Maybe it'll even be, you know, October and you'll be there for Halloween.
Oh, wow.
In terms of the presidential press conference, he talked about this morning, he did it from the briefing room right before he goes on vacation. He talked about Iran as a destabilizing influence, and he said there are going to be consequences for them exporting explosive devices. Well, I wonder if there's any consequences for any of the other countries exporting them to the Sunnis.
Yeah, Saudi Arabia, the point in case, more than half of all the foreign fighters arrested in Iraq or killed in Iraq identified have been from Saudi Arabia. And in fact, the only source that is saying that these bombs that are blowing up our troops are coming from Iran was some unnamed military source who was quoted by one reporter in the New York Times day before yesterday or yesterday. And there's no corroboration of this. There's no consensus in the military community. There's a number of articles that I've been able to find suggesting that, in fact, Iran's got nothing to do with this. But it sounds to me, when Bush starts talking about consequences, it sounds to me like he's foreshadowing an attack on Iran.
Exactly my read on it.
Yeah. So you, when do you think that might happen? And could that be the thing that you know?
Could this be our new October surprise?
Right,
even
right.
Though it's not quite an election year, I have no idea. But that scared me. Something else that scared me, what he said today. He was asked about Gonzalez, and he said he hasn't seen Congress say that he's done anything wrong, and why hold somebody accountable when they've done nothing? But then he goes on to say, Congress should deliver legislation. Well, this is a paraphrase, but basically, Congress should deliver legislation rather than being the investigative body. I don't know about you, but I was like, you could have knocked me over with a feather. I was so shocked.
This is what happens when you have, as president, a guy who, in his undergraduate studies, studied history, but obviously never showed up, you know, paid somebody to take his tests and to write his term papers, which was, frankly, a very common practice in the 1960s, particularly at universities like Yale and you know, upscale universities, although at MSU I saw a lot of it. In fact, a friend of mine started a company back in the late 60s selling term papers. It was the hot thing to do in 1969. And then goes off to get his degree, his MBA from Harvard. And business, you know, corporations are not democracies. They're kingdoms. And so, I mean, all of his training, to the extent that he's had any, has been in how to run a kingdom. He's not a lawyer. He's got no background in democracy.
But let's face it. I mean, he has read the Constitution as President of the United States. All right. I'll disagree with you. I think he understands quite well.
Then he's lying to us.
Well, perhaps. But he does understand that Congress is an investigative body as well. It has oversight by the Constitution.
Yeah. Well, then why would he say not? So you think that he's simply being disingenuous?
To
be charitable.
Yes, to be charitable. He basically also said, now this is another disingenuous moment, he said there's no closing of Gitmo unless they have essentially these 350 people are willing to be taken in by certain countries.
Right.
And then he also said they need to be tried for their crimes. Well, excuse me, the Brits are trying to get their guys out of Guantanamo.
Right.
They're more than happy to take them back into the country.
Yeah. And then he added, a lot of countries don't want killers. Well, wait a minute. A lot of these people are not, you know, where's the evidence that they're killers? Produce the evidence, put them on trial.
And a fair trial.
Yeah. I mean, a real trial.
A fair trial, exactly. Yeah. He also talked about terrorism, and he talked about Musharraf and how Musharraf is willing to do what's necessary. He'll take swift action. But as I think I said to you on this show, we have information that the White House is ready to get those C-130s ready to take Musharraf out if there is an internal coup, which some people are predicting there is going to be in Pakistan.
So this is a replay of the Shah of Iran.
I think so. And I have always said that he is, Musharraf is Saddam light.
Yeah. Now, yesterday or the day before, Musharraf was supposed to show up at a gig that Karzai was doing with 600 tribal leaders from Afghanistan and Pakistan.
And he said that he had issues in Islamabad. And
right.
Said,
he backed out. I'm guessing that he figured out or he was told that if he showed up, they were going to take him hostage or try to kill him.
Well, either that or he won't be showing back up in Islamabad.
If he leaves town, then, well, yeah. I mean, this is a guy who came to power by a military coup.
That's right.
He certainly has to be looking over his shoulder wondering if somebody's going to do to him what he did to the person before him.
Exactly.
Amazing.
Exactly. On the mortgage crisis, he said there would be no direct grants to homeowners and then said that the government needs to do more education.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the solution for everything. Your job's been outsourced? Go get a PhD. It's incredible. Ellen Ratner. Ellen, thank you very much for the report.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. Stick around.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Our quote for the day from Franklin Roosevelt. Here is my principle, he said. Taxes should be levied according to ability to pay. That is the only American principle. Phil Kirpin would beg to differ. Phil is the policy director for Americans for Prosperity, AmericansForProsperity.org, their website. Hey, Phil, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Tom.
You guys sent out a news release a week or so back. The headline, Americans for Prosperity says, John Edwards' plan to hike capital gains taxes 87% would smash middle-income retirement nest eggs, bring in less money than current lower rate. And just to put this in context, right now, if you earn your living working for a living, like I do and I'm assuming you do, then you pay a maximum income tax rate that goes into the low 30s. And on the other hand, if you earn your living as the heir of inherited wealth, like the Walton family or sitting on your butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive, if that's how you earn your living, you pay a maximum income tax of 15%.
Well, that's
arguing that John
that's
Edwards.
Not really accurate, Tom.
Well, you're arguing that John Edwards saying that capital gains should be taxed at the same rate as ordinary income is going to ruin the economy. What am I missing here?
Well, it's not accurate to say that people who are paying capital gains tax are paying lower taxes. They're paying higher taxes because that income's already been subject to a 35% corporate tax. What we're talking about is the double taxation of corporate sourced income. It's been taxed 35% at the corporate level. Then when it's distributed to individuals, there's an additional layer of taxation with the capital gains or dividend tax. And, quoted FDR. I'm going to quote another great Democratic president. John Kennedy, and he said that the tax on capital gains directly affects investment decisions, the mobility and flow of risk capital from static to more dynamic situations, the ease or difficulty experienced by new ventures in obtaining capital, and thereby the strength and potential for growth of the economy.
And you know what the capital gains tax was at the time he said that?
The capital gains tax at the time that he said that was that there was a 50% exclusion and from the regular income rate. So it would have been as high as 45% for people in the 90% bracket.
Right.
He wanted to cut it to I believe 20%.
Right. Well, and
which would be lower than the rate
that
Edwards is talking about now, from a much higher starting point. And the Edwards proposal to go to 28%.
Phil, hang on. Let's just stop for a second. A minute ago, you said that people who are paying a maximum 15% income tax rate on the money that they're getting from their dividends are paying taxes twice. And I just, this is a meme that we've got to address this issue. If I buy a bunch of stock in Walmart or ExxonMobil, and I've got enough money that I can buy enough stock that I can live on the dividend income from that, you're telling me that it's a good thing that I should only pay a maximum income tax rate of 15% because somehow I have paid taxes prior to receiving that income?
Of course you have. Of course you have, Tom. The value of a stock is the present discount value of that company's earnings. Now, those earnings are subject to a 35% corporate income tax. That's why the capital gains tax is a double tax. That same income.
It's not a double tax. It's a tax on the corporation.
Right. What's
it's a tax on the income to the corporation. A corporation is an independent entity.
Tom,
it is a person at law.
Taxes. They only collect them. The tax that's levied on a corporation or any business can only be paid in one of three ways. It can be paid by workers in the form of lower wages or fewer jobs, or it can be paid by consumers in the form of higher prices, or it can be paid by shareholders in the form of lower returns. Only human beings pay taxes. Those are the only three ways in which a corporation can comply with a tax.
And I would submit to you that using those three examples, number one, lowering prices in the marketplace, the price in the marketplace has nothing to do with the tax the corporations are paying. It has to do with what the marketplace will bear for that good or service. You've got companies that as they offshored and started making their products in cheaper and cheaper fashions, from sneakers to television sets, did not lower their prices. They raised them in many cases. Secondly, you're
That's
not going
to
see.
My point. They have to raise prices to pay the corporate tax.
It had no. As their taxes went down, you got most
Those
of the major corporations in America
are
paying only a small fragment of that 35%
where
that you're
the
talking
money come
about.
From to pay the
it
corporate
It comes
tax.
Out of the hands. Your third point is right. It reduces shareholder returns. Absolutely.
Okay, so those shareholders
it reduces profits.
Tax. The capital gains is a double tax. You're talking about income that's already been taxed at the 35% rate because
it has not already
been. You just said it yourself, Tom. You said
my income.
Shareholder's pocket.
I have not been taxed as a shareholder. The corporation has been taxed, and the corporation is using the commons that are being paid for by
that
tax, Phil. The commons that corporation is using. That corporation is hiring people who are educated with tax dollars. It is using roads that are paid for with tax dollars. It is using communications infrastructure that is paid for with tax dollars. It is using governmental infrastructure that's paid for with tax dollars. It's using a stable currency that's paid for with tax dollars. It should pay its share of the cost of the commons that allow it to function as a corporation. And you're suggesting the corporation should not pay any income taxes at all.
I asked you where the money comes from to pay the corporate tax.
It comes from the corporation.
You said it comes from shareholders.
Well, ultimately, yeah. By and large, corporations are not going to be the labor market and the cost of product goods and services in the market. There are independent forces that are much larger than taxes.
Thank you very much. So you've agreed then that the corporate tax is paid by shareholders. The capital gains and dividend tax is a double tax on already taxed income.
No, I have not agreed.
It encourages capital formation.
I have not agreed. What I am saying is that the corporation is paying that tax in exchange for the services it is using.
Well, of course it
and
is.
When
so
that
corporation
has
the
a profit
to pay the tax?
From the income from doing business.
Right.
It doesn't get it from the shareholders. It's not getting it from me. The corporation
isn't
taking that money out of my pocket.
Well, that's money that would be returned to shareholders if it weren't removed in taxation, if it can't be passed on to consumers or workers.
Well, obviously your justification for that is that there should be no corporate tax whatsoever, but you could use that exact same logic to say that
I'm
a corporation
should
be able to just walk up to anybody
taxation.
In the United States.
I'm saying there should not be double taxation of corporate source income. If you have a corporate tax, you should...
Phil, I put you on the other board. I'm going to put you on hold here for a second. You're going to let me finish a sentence once in a while. Actually, I'm going to put you back on. Phil, finish your sentence.
What I'm saying is not that there should be no corporate tax, but that there should either be a corporate tax or a capital gains tax, but not both. You're taxing the same income twice.
And your point in saying that, Phil, and I just want to make the point, this is not Fox News, and our goal isn't to shout over each other. Your point in saying that is that a corporation is not an individual entity. And I'm saying that a corporation is an individual entity. It does use the commons, and it should pay for those commons. And why would you say that the corporation should not pay for those commons?
Well, that's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying that you have to tax an income flow. I'm saying that taxing the same income flow multiple times is bad economic policy, and it's misleading to say that the tax that's paid at the individual level is the only tax on a stream of income that's been taxed at the corporate level already.
But it's not the same income flow. If a corporation is using the commons, and they are, then why should they not pay taxes on that?
It's the same.
I still don't get it.
It's the same income flow because the value of a corporate stock is the discount present value of future earnings. Those earnings are subject to a corporate income tax.
In part.
Economically, it's the same flow.
It's also the value of the stock also represents the assets of the corporation as well, and it represents the future assets of the corporation, and
the
it represents intangibles like goodwill in the name.
Well, sure, but the value of those are dependent on the business income that they can generate, which is subject to tax. I'll make a further point about the capital gains tax, which is that if our goal here is to raise revenue for social spending or for whatever other objectives we think are important, this is a very poor vehicle for doing that. We've seen four changes in the capital gains tax rate since 1981. We've seen cuts in 1981, 1997 under President Clinton, and 2003. All of those cuts led to dramatic increases in revenues. We saw an increase in 1986 under President Reagan. That was a mistake. It led to a dramatic decline in capital gains tax revenues. This seems to be the tax rate that has the that is most sensitive in terms of the growth effect that it has. Income tax cuts do not pay for themselves.
No, your point is well made, but I would submit to you that's a temporary and short-term thing. We owned a business, for example, in 1986, and my wife and I, and we sold that business specifically because the capital gains was going up. And, I mean, people make decisions based like that, and so I would agree with you that this is not a tax that you want to be jacking up and down every other year because you're going to see wild perturbations in business activity. But to say that just because the capital gains tax in and of itself is blocking corporate revenue or income, for that matter, the federal government, you really have to look at a 10 or 20 year window. You can't be looking at 5 year windows.
Well, the capital gains tax for corporations is at the full 35% rate, which is a particularly harmful policy because that's not a double tax, it's a triple tax. When a corporation owns stock in another corporation and sells it, that shouldn't be subject to taxation at all.
I don't think corporations should be allowed to own stock in other corporations. Can I own a person? I can't. Corporations shouldn't be able to own another corporation.
Well, I think that would be a very harmful policy idea. The idea of prohibiting strategic acquisitions, I think, would be very harmful. We've seen a lot of economies of scale and consolidation. I'd like to see the unlocking of some of those capital assets to lower corporate capital gains rate.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, well, people can read all about it over at your website, AmericansForForProsperity.org. Phil Kirpin. Phil, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
That's right. The labor press is gone. I mean, when I was back in the old days, when I was a kid, I remember growing up in Michigan, we had the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press. The Detroit Free Press, as I recall, was the corporate paper and had the business section and always editorialized Republican. And the Detroit News, as I recall, I might have them reversed. It's been a lot of years. The Detroit News was the labor paper. And had a labor section, and maybe one page about business, but it had a whole labor section, and always editorialized democratically. Big D, party. The labor press is gone. It's been killed off all across America. Big corporate-owned papers, they not only do not want labor pages, they're busting unions inside their own newspapers. Labor is not covered in the national media. We have a corporatocracy, essentially. Corporations writing more than 90% of all legislation introduced in the last year that the Republicans controlled the House and Senate. We don't have numbers yet for the first Democratic year. More than 90% of all legislation written in its initial form by corporate lobbyists. 90% plus. So we have corporations making the laws. Corporations telling us, you know, I mean, making the laws. We're talking about the force of government. We're talking about, as libertarians say, men with guns. I mean, you know, government is the one entity out there that has the legal power to use force. Corporations writing those rules. And the big push now, going back to, actually, in a way, this ties in with what we were talking about in the first hour. Going back to a new and different form of governance. Corporate rule. Oh, and by the way, let's make sure that they don't pay any taxes at all. Let corporations use the commons all they want. Let them dump their waste, and we all have to pay for it with our tax dollars. The Superfund site is no longer paid for by corporations. It's paid for by you and me, for example. Superfund sites all over the country. Internalize profits, externalize costs, pay no taxes, and then when those corporations spin off profits for their owners, those people pay a maximum 15% income tax. And I just, you know, I respectfully disagree with all the folks on the right who say, you know, this is how it should be. I don't think so. If you look at the United States during the period of time when we had a top marginal tax rate of 70 to 90%, a top capital gains rate that was, you know, pushing 50%, we had a top corporate rate that was in the 50% range. When corporate, in the 1950s, under a Republican president with a Republican House and a Republican Senate, and we had corporations paying 35% of all the revenue that was paid in income taxes, and we had a top tax rate of 91% in income taxes, what we had was no emerging billionaires. There were no dynasties being created during that time. And we had the strongest and most powerful and most vital middle class and manufacturing infrastructure in the history of the world. It worked. And then Reagan came along and said, oh, we're going to deconstruct this. We're going to take this apart. We're going to hand power over to corporations. We're going to say that they're people, that they can lobby. From the day that George Bush came into office until today, the number of lobbyists, registered lobbyists in Washington, D.C. has more than doubled. It's over 30,000 now, just in the last 6 years. Because Bush is Reagan on steroids. He's doing what Reagan was doing, only he's doing it much more rapidly and much more effectively. And that is turning control of government over to corporations. And you know, Mussolini and Franco had a name for that. The merging of corporate and state interests is called fascism. And then they say, well, and if the president wants to wiretap you, by the way, with a little help from his corporate buddies, you have no recourse, and it's perfectly legal, etc. And if somebody wants to earn their living sitting on their butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive, they shouldn't pay taxes like the little people do. They live in a different universe. They fly in their private jets. They live in their gated communities or on their private islands. They take a vacation on their own private yachts. What, pay taxes like the rest of us? I am not, by the way, trashing wealth. I've had my own share of it in my life. There's nothing wrong with accumulating a lot of money, in my opinion. What's wrong is saying, because I have a lot of money, I live by a different set of rules than the rest of the world or the rest of America. That's what's wrong. Warren Buffett hit the nail so right on the head when he points out that he pays in the neighborhood of 15% income taxes, and his secretary pays in the neighborhood of 33% income taxes, and there's something wrong with that when he's the billionaire. And she's not. So, anyhow. You can make up your own mind. 27 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, your telephone number, Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. Timothy Carr, very interesting blog over at the Huffington Post. I'm unable to independently corroborate this, although there's a YouTube of it. It looks like it's solid, and well, we're gonna continue tracking this down. But what he says is, over the weekend, AT&T gave us a glimpse of their plans for the web when they censored a Pearl Jam performance that didn't meet their standard of internet freedom. During a live Lollapalooza webcast of a concert by the Seattle-based supergroup, the telco giant muted lead singer Eddie Vedder just as he launched into a lyric against President George W. Bush. The lines, "George Bush, leave this world alone," and "George Bush, find yourself another home," were somehow lost in the mix. Yeah. I don't know. I find it hard to believe that a giant corporation would do that. You know, I don't find it hard to believe that some bozo working for a giant corporation would do that. Some guy who's like in the stream was, "I don't like it." And you know, thinking that nobody will ever notice or whatever. But I don't know. We'll keep an eye on that one. That's interesting. AT&T, of course, one of the major opponents of net neutrality legislation. But, you know, whether they have any play in this, I just don't know. Sam in La Mesa, California. Hey, Sam, welcome to the program. Thanks for listening to KLSD.
Yeah, Tom, the conversation you had with the argument you had with the prior speaker was very, very interesting, but to me, very, very laughable. If corporations are identified legally as an individual, then why aren't they taxed as an individual is taxed?
Yeah.
I mean, the logic there is impeccable.
Right. They're claiming Fourth Amendment rights of privacy. They're claiming Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination. This is how the asbestos and tobacco companies kept their, you know, head below the radar for 50 years. First Amendment rights of free speech. You had Nike out there claiming that. 14th Amendment rights.
Why should they have any more privacy rights than any other individual?
Yeah, well, I don't think that they should have any privacy rights. Corporations exist at the pleasure of we the people. We will them into being by allowing at the state level for people to get together and do business in a way that violates the normal rules of society. That is to say, their liability is limited.
Then we the people should be allowed to tax them.
Yeah, I agree. Well said, Sam. Thanks a lot for the call. And really, that's the bottom line. I mean, if you're going to give special privileges to a group of people because they've decided that they're going to engage in business, and that's what we do when you create a corporation. And I say this as a person who has created 7 corporations in his life that have made a lot of money over the years. And the corporations say, I've not done all that bad myself. And I own a corporation right now which owns this show. Speaking as somebody who has used the corporate vehicle for more than 30 years, I think that it is a separate entity and should be treated as such. I mean, it's just that simple. Elizabeth in Diamond Bar, California. Hey, Elizabeth.
Yes, Mr. Hartman. Thank you for taking my call. I called to respectfully disagree with a comment that you made, and I was kind of surprised. But first off, grant me a little bit of extra time. I am very concerned about losing our civil liberties, as was my ancestor, Patrick Henry. And as far as Feinstein, that was the comment where you spoke about her voting for both bills.
Right.
So one would get through. And I hope I heard it right, or possibly I didn't, but her reading of both bills, how she didn't understand all of it, it was confusing, and she didn't quite finish reading all the bills.
Yeah.
Then why in God's name would she sign one?
I do not disagree. I agree with you.
Yeah,
but there is a...
You referred to it. I'm sorry. I don't mean to interrupt you.
No, it's quite all right.
You referred to it where I disagree with you. As you said, you know, I don't want to come down on either Dianne Feinstein or Barbara
Mikulski.
Yes. You said, you know, it was a mistake they made. It was. I can't even categorize it as a mistake. I think it's a dereliction of, if you want to call it duty or job. Or she has been Feinstein since I live in California. You know, how long has she been a senator? You do not sign anything if you do not understand it when it pertains to people's liberties.
Yeah, I agree that they should have spent more time on it. She should not have voted for it. I agree with you.
Yeah, but
and
it's more than a mistake. Do you not think?
Yes, I think it's more than a mistake.
Oh, good.
I don't totally disagree with you. And I think that all of us have to consider the political calculus here and consider the position that these people find themselves in.
I
understand.
I don't mean to sound ugly. I apologize.
No, I absolutely understand, Elizabeth, and I thank you for your comments.
Could I make one quick comment about a book? I don't remember the author, but I read None Dare Call It Treason.
By John Stormer.
Yes.
I read that in 1965.
Was that unbelievable?
Well, that's the book that really started the John Birch Society. You know, None Dare Call It
Treason.
None Dare Call It Treason. I mean, it started, but it was their Bible. That's.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So well informed, and I know it's all through, you know, you're working at it, and I really admire you.
Well, thank you. Elizabeth, thank you very much. There's a point I have to make here, and I appreciate your call. And None Dare Call It Treason is the right-wing Bible, still is. It was all about the communists and the State Department, for those of you who don't know. But here's the point I started to make earlier about consider the political calculus in this. If, God forbid, there was another attack in the United States, a spectacular attack, I mean, as in, you know, large, impossible to ignore, another 9/11 kind of thing, there are going to be two competing storylines about what happened, just as there were hours after 9/11. One of those storylines is going to be, how could George Bush have let this happen? He wasn't paying attention. He didn't secure our ports. He wasn't checking the cargo on the airliners. You know, blah, 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 blah. How could George Bush have let this happen? That's going to be one of the storylines. And along with that storyline will probably be, and these people are criminals, and we should pull the world together in a unified group and all the police agencies around the world and find them and prosecute them as criminals. That's the one storyline. The other storyline, the competing storyline, is those Democrats prevented Bush from stopping this from happening. Those Democrats didn't give Bush the tools he needed to prevent this from happening, and it's the blood is on their hands and it's all their fault. Now, if the media in the United States was completely, literally fair and balanced, if there was a broad level of impartiality, if we actually had news, and we didn't have reporters who were basically stenographers for the White House in most of the White House press corps, and we didn't have the vast majority of all talk radio in America being right-wing talk radio, you could say, let those two arguments compete with each other in the marketplace of ideas. But look back at what happened after 9/11. Those two arguments were being put out then, too. And the argument that said, you know, George Bush was warned that this was coming. The argument that said, you know, why Dick Cheney was put in charge of the Homeland Security Task Force in January of 2001, and it never met before 9/11. Instead, he had his Energy Task Force meeting where they were planning on how to carve up Iraq. That storyline, which, by the way, is a true storyline, that never made it through to the American people. And then on top of that, if you're a senator or a member of the House of Representatives, you remember that when the Patriot Act after 9/11 was dropped in the laps of Congress, there were only two guys who could have stopped it. Pat Leahy, who was the head of the Senate Judiciary Committee, because the Democrats had, for that little window of time there, the Democrats had control of the Senate. Remember, because the Republican senator from Vermont said, I'm out of here. Jim Jeffords. So as a consequence of that, Pat Leahy, who is the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, he could have blocked that committee, that bill, the Patriot Act, in committee. And if he passed it through committee, Tom Daschle could have blocked that on the floor of the Senate. Because these were the two guys who had the ability to say yes or no to whether or not a vote was going to be held on a piece of legislation. And who, right after the Patriot Act was introduced, and both of these guys had come out with some statements that indicated that they had some doubts about this piece of legislation, who were the only two members of Congress who were subject to assassination attempts? Five, six other people were murdered, and they tried to murder Pat Leahy and Tom Daschle, the only two members of Congress who got anthrax in the mail. So you're a member of Congress, and you see Bush coming down the road, and you're hearing from the intelligence community, it looks like a hit is coming. And that seems to be the primary meme right now. And I'm hearing this from a number of lawmakers that all the intelligence community is saying there's another hit coming on the United States. And after all we've done, Bush has done everything he can to try and generate one. He's inflamed the entire Muslim world. He's created, the president of Egypt came out and said that if Bush invaded Iraq, he would create 100 bin Ladens. Well, we've created 1,000 bin Ladens. And when that hit happens, God forbid, if it happens, what's the storyline that's going to prevail? Will it be the thing that flips us into 100 years of Republican rule? And let's hope not. And I think that at a certain level with this vote, as terrible and tragic as it was, some of these Democrats were trying to give themselves, in my opinion, political cover for an event like that. And it's a lousy way to legislate, and it's a lousy reality, but it's a reality that we all have to acknowledge. Back with your calls right after this. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. Celebrities
all come to see us, grateful they don't have to be us. Politicians play their best face card. Where is Bubba? Where's our leader? Where's our favorite lip reader? AWOL from the Texas National Guard. George W. told the nation, this is not an escalation. This is just a surge toward victory. Just to win my little war, I'm sending 20,000 more to help me save Iraq from Iraqis.
9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman with you. Jay in Los Angeles. Hey, Jay, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine. And I will get better. Damn it.
Right, your last caller was talking about capital gains taxes being somehow a double taxation on the investor or stockholder,
right,
or something like that. That does make no sense, because you only get taxed capital gains if you sold the stock at a profit. And if that corporation is able to raise its stock price by paying its corporate income tax fairly, that's a good thing. But if it's not, then, you know, that's still not double taxation. You know, if an investor holds a stock, he's not being taxed capital gains. If you sell at a loss, you're not being taxed capital gains. You're only taxed capital gains if you sell that stock after it's gone up, right?
Yeah, that's a good point.
So,
but if it's an income tax, when you sell it at a profit, that's where the profit is generated, and that's when you have income. And so if the point of an income tax is to tax income, that would be where the income is selling the stock at a profit. Or you know, in the case of dividend taxes on the dividend, you know, the income. I just see it as there are these two entities. There's, you know, us individual people, and there's corporations. And both as entities, and this is not an argument in favor of corporate personhood, but both as entities are using resources, and they're using the commons and should be paying the price of the commons. It's real simple. Taxes are the price you pay for membership in a civil society. And for a corporation, taxes are the price you pay for having the right to do business. And the fact that you generate a profit and that profit goes to the owners of the corporation is independent of that, in my in my opinion.
Sure, I'd just like to say that in addition to individuals and corporations, there are probably individuals who are as powerful and as wealthy as some corporations, and there are individuals who get in the market just to day trade and flip stocks and speculate. And if you, you know, as opposed to the average investor who wants to buy and hold a stock for the long term, but right. at any rate, they're not just cashing out or day trading and flipping stocks. And,
right, and by saying that if dividend and income from capital gains is only taxed at 15%, what are we doing? We're increasing churn. Frankly, if it's short-term capital gains as well, you're increasing market volatility. This is, you know, a territory that could get very, very dangerous, frankly, for the United States.
Yeah, we're there now. The volatility is off the chart.
Yeah, yeah. And then taxes have historically acted as a stabilizer. I think that's why the 60s, 70s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s were, early 80s until Reagan got a hold of the economy, were a relatively stable, slow and steady building, but you know, strong middle-class building time. Jay, good point. Thank you very much. Lee in Milwaukee, Oregon. Hey, Lee.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to let you know I'm speaking as someone who made his living as a reporter for 30 years up until this year. And I watched the Presidential News Stenographers Conference this morning. I don't know if you saw or heard. It was pathetic.
Yeah, I mean, pieces of it. Yeah.
Well, once again, they're, you know, joking around, laughing with him, which is absolutely the worst attitude to go into a news conference when you've got such serious issues on the table. They didn't ask any questions about the new warrantless wiretap law that I heard or anything about Bush's staff ignoring congressional subpoenas. And yet, after all this was over, I happened to turn it over on MSNBC and saw Chris Matthews, and he goes, you know, Bush really looked strong today. Boy, that was a great performance. I could not believe it.
Yeah, well, he's, you know, the guy who's the most concerned about how people are looking, and yeah, it's. I agree with you, Lee, and it's a tragedy that that's the state of journalism in America. I don't think we can even call it journalism anymore. It's infotainment. Thanks a lot for the call. Point well made. Maureen in the Pyrenees in France. Hey,
yes. Yes. Hello, Tom.
Welcome to the program.
Here I am. Thank you so much. Tom, I have utmost admiration and respect for you. And I'd like to say, are you going to be the man with the courage who has already shown us the pattern of intimidation from the right wing, is going to be the person to say what we all know now to be true, and which I've known for 7 years to be true, that our lawmakers have been stampeded from day one, and they are being terrorized, and we all know who is at the root of this problem. And is there a war on terror, or are the terrorists sitting in the White House?
Yeah, no, this a couple days ago on this program, I said I will walk right up to the edge of calling George W. Bush a terrorist.
Thank you, but will you walk over that edge? Because it's time.
Well, I think it's a matter of language.
Yes.
Because you know, you can argue, okay, terrorists kill people, you know, to achieve their political ends, and George Bush has killed hundreds of thousands of people in Iraq,
right.
Et cetera. But I think that there still is, even as terrible as Bush is and as a president, there still is a fundamental and profound moral difference between George Bush and what he has done and you know, is continuing to do. And what was done on what was done to us in 9/11, or what Tim McVeigh did in Oklahoma, and I just don't want to conflate the two. I think that we need to keep that line, that bright line there, and call him something else. I think that we should call him a criminal. I think we should call him an indicted, you know, an impeached president. We should call him an ex-president. But I do acknowledge, Maureen, and I've been saying it on this show for years.
Yes.
That terror is being used by this administration, and the war on, and as a club, they're not necessarily the ones generating the terror, but they're the ones promulgating it, and that's in some ways even worse, because that's exactly what, assuming that Bin Laden was behind all this stuff, that's exactly what he wanted.
Exactly, and who was facilitating Bin Laden? And who stampeded our Congress with the Patriot Act under threat of anthrax letters? And who stampeded them during the War Powers Act, except for Wellstone, and we know how he ended up? And who stampeded the invasion into Iraq because supposedly the weather was right, when we all know
what's the
weather
consensus?
Was right?
Yeah, no, I get it. We just have a couple seconds left, Maureen, and I got a quick question for you. You live in France. What's the?
Yes, I'm an American. I'm a voting American citizen.
But how do most French people view this?
Oh, well, they are exactly. What I'm saying and what you've been leading us to understand and what I've understood for a long time. We know who is behind it. Not only did they promulgate it, but they have facilitated it and benefited from it. And as the Italians say, cui bono.
Yeah, yeah. Maureen, thank you very much for the call and for your thoughts. 57 minutes past the hour. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
So one of the topics that we've been discussing today, in between arguments about whether taxing capital gains is double taxation, maybe we should rephrase that. One of the folks in the chat room pointed out, isn't it double taxation when I pay sales tax with money that I paid income tax on? Yeah. And we all agree that's fine. Anyhow. In between the conversations about that, there's been this conversation of what's really going on in the United States. Is it conceivable that there has been or could be essentially a coup, an overthrow of our elected government, a takeover of our elected government by literally fascists, corporatists, people who believe that corporations should run this country rather than democracy, rather than we the people? People who don't believe in democracy, small d democracy. It has happened nearly before. There's a History Channel special about this over at history.com. You can track it down. It's called The Plot to Overthrow FDR. And you just go over to history.com and type in The Plot to Overthrow FDR. And the producer and director of it, Andy Corwin, who's also the noted folk singer from the Limelighters, limelighters.com, L-I-T-E-R-S, and Andy Corwin, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. And I loved your music as the Limelighters, and you're producing and directing this documentary. It's quite a different thing and quite a great effort.
Well, I've been working in documentary film really since the early 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
This particular film that we're talking about was something that I did back in 1998. Mm-hmm. I think it aired in 1999. And it's aired several times since then, to the best of my knowledge. It wasn't something that I discovered and went to the History Channel with a pitch. It was an assignment that I was given.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time that I was given the assignment, I had never heard of General Smedley Butler.
Yeah, let's start with this guy. He joined the Marine Corps in 1898 mm-hmm. to fight in the Spanish-American War, much like Teddy Roosevelt.
He lied about his age, incidentally.
Oh,
he
really?
Wasn't quite 17 years old
yeah.
when he joined the Marine Corps.
Uh-huh.
And with a commission as a second lieutenant to fight in the Spanish-American War.
Mm-hmm.
And then over the next 33 years, he rose to the rank of major general, which was the highest rank attainable in the Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm. He was also wildly famous in the United States. He was a very, very highly regarded man.
Absolutely.
A national
absolutely.
Hero.
And beloved,
two Congressional Medals of Honor.
Two Congressional Medals of Honor, one of which he tried to give back because he didn't think he deserved it.
Wow.
But he was adored by men who served under him. He was a real soldier's general.
Yeah.
Which led to a lot of headbutting with the his peers who had been through military colleges. Butler was a guy who earned his bones, made his bones in combat.
Right. So here's this general. And he's got enormous power. He's got enormous public support, and has the military with him to a large extent. And he is approached by whom?
Let me back up and correct one thing. Not so much the military with him. It was the veterans, the World War
yeah.
I veterans.
Yeah.
And here you kind of have to, as a preamble to this, there's the story of the Bonus Army
mm-hmm.
in 1932. When the World War I vets came to Washington in 32 to demand early payment of the bonus that Congress had awarded them in the early 20s, Butler was one of the people who addressed these guys. You know,
he was on their side. This is the Bonus Army, wasn't it, that MacArthur rode his horse through and attacked?
One of the darkest days in our history was July 28, 1932, when regular Army troops attacked World War I veterans who had come to Washington to protest. And these veterans had taken over abandoned buildings, and they had built a shanty town on the banks of the Potomac.
They called it a Hooverville, didn't they?
Hooverville, exactly. Yeah. This was an election year.
Hoover was the president, the Republican.
Precisely. And the veterans had come to demand their bonus. And this was in the darkest days of the Depression, a lot of unemployed guys. A lot of them brought their wives and their kids.
Right. So Butler defended them, and so he was a hero among these people. But you know, we've only have another 4 minutes here. So
perceived as somebody who could inspire them.
Yes.
To form into a militia, a la Mussolini's black shirts.
Or Hitler's brown shirts, for that matter. They were not military. They were a private independent army, sort of like Blackwater.
Precisely. And the story of this plot, to encapsulate, is that there was this perception that the Mussolini model could be attempted here in the United States.
Right.
And
Gerald
that the militia was necessary to accomplish it.
Right. And so Gerald McGuire, representing the American Liberty League, this is a group that was funded by Morgan, DuPont, some of the real captains of industry. Apparently Prescott Bush was in on this.
Well,
so I've heard, approached Butler in 1934.
It's possible that Prescott Bush was involved in it, or that he knew these people, and he may have been involved in it. He wasn't among the names that Butler named before the congressional committee that was formed to investigate the allegation that he had been approached by a representative of a powerful cabal of industrialists to lead this citizens' militia against Washington and intimidate Roosevelt to step down and to appoint Butler to a new cabinet position where he would be the de facto dictator of the United States. But what these people failed to take into consideration was that General Smedley Butler was the ultimate patriot. He smelled a rat and he blew the whistle. And it led to, I think, is one of the great ironies of this story, it led to the creation, for the first time in the fall of 1934, the House Un-American Activities Committee was formed, originally to investigate a right-wing plot to overthrow democracy in the United States.
And what's amazing, there's a new British documentary out about this, and they went back to Washington, D.C. and said to the archivists, let us see the records from the House Un-American Activities Committee's investigations. And this was an investigation that lasted almost a year. It was a major investigation. And the folder had about a dozen pieces of paper in it. I mean, it was one little tiny thin folder, and that's all that was left. When you were investigating this six years ago, did you find more information about that, or had the files already been purged?
Well, they were purged back in 1935, and it was and Butler famously went on the radio, WCAU in Philadelphia, and angrily denounced the committee for removing the names of DuPont and Morgan and Al Smith. John W. Davis, prominent Democrats, General Hugh Johnson, who was in Roosevelt's inner circle, who headed up the NRA and later the WPA.
This was a bipartisan attempt. It was really corporatists against democracy, not Republicans against Democrats.
Precisely.
Because Franklin Roosevelt was taking a whack at corporations. He had called them economic royalists, the robber barons, and he said, Our allegiance to democracy requires the overthrow of this kind of corporate power.
Absolutely, right. But a lot of the entrenched interests were actually in the Democratic Party itself.
Interesting.
The right wing of the Democratic Party that was mostly represented by Al Smith.
Yeah, the Joe Lieberman of his day.
The Joe Lieberman of his day, precisely.
Yeah. It's an absolutely incredible story. It's
For people who would like to really read it, because it's a very, very complex story, I think the definitive book written about this was The Plot to Seize the White House by Jules Archer, which has recently been re-released.
Yeah, I have it.
And of course,
Smedley Butler's War is a Racket. I mean, you know, Smedley Butler had his own... his own take on not just that, but actually it wasn't so much about that, but, you know, what he did before working for the corporate powers. But amazing. Mm-hmm. Andy Corwin, Limelighters, LITERS.com. If you want the music,
yeah.
go to history.com to check out the plot to overthrow FDR, the producer and director of that documentary. Andy, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Good talking with you. 15 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
Celebrities all come to see us, grateful they don't have to be us. Politicians play their best face card. Where is Bubba? Where's our leader? Where's our favorite lip reader? AWOL from the Texas National Guard. George W. told the nation, this is not an escalation. This is just a surge short victory. Just to win my little war, I'm sending 20,000 more to help me save Iraq from Iraqis.
Yes, we got to save Iraq from those Iraqis, you know. They,
you're hunkered in Fallujah.
They're Muslims, you know, and brown people, by and large. They're not Christians, and they don't speak English. And, oh, my God.
It just boggles my mind. I remember during the Vietnam War, you know, over 2 million Vietnamese were killed in the Vietnam War. 56,000 Americans, a terrible tragedy, and 2 million Vietnamese. And very few people talk about that. Very few people are talking about the hundreds of thousands of Iraqis killed. Oh, we're coming up on 4,000 Americans. Terrible thing. But isn't human life human life?
Anyhow, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Joan in Petaluma, California. Hey, Joan, what's up?
Oh, Joan? No, Joan.
Joan! Oh, Joan, did you
you're,
say Joan?
You're on the air?
I'm sorry.
That's quite all right.
Thank you for taking my call. Sure. I was just dazing here. I have a concern about Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
I have a friend who is a diver. Oops. I have a friend who's a diver, and he's going back for a second time to Iraq. He's contracted by the Navy, and when I spoke to him, he'll be underwater about 4 miles from land. And I asked him, I said, well, what were you doing? Can you tell me? He said, no, that's confidential. It just scares me.
Mm-hmm.
I have a real concern about this.
You're thinking that this has something to do with an upcoming invasion of Iran?
Yeah, I do.
Or Iran, I guess is the
question. And I just wanted to put it out there. Maybe I shouldn't have, because he said it was confidential.
Yeah, well, he didn't reveal any details to you, and you haven't revealed any details on the air, other than the fact that, you know, a guy has a job. But I think all of us are very concerned about what George Bush might do in Iran, and about how, if there's not another 9/11, that they'll generate the equivalent of it by attacking Iran. I mean,
yeah.
You know, that would be as big a political explosion as something happening here. And many of us are concerned about it. And it's one of the reasons why we need to be letting our elected officials know that we support them. I am frankly a little concerned, even in my own rhetoric today, you know, talking about, for example, Dianne Feinstein voting for this FISA law without having, you know, insane on the floor of the Senate that she really didn't understand it, but was going to vote for it. And here's the problem. If we beat these people upside the head and say, you know, how dare you, that's a terrible thing, you know, blah, 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 blah. What we really need to be saying to them is, have the courage of your convictions in the future, because we're here with you. You know, we need to be pushing them, not pounding on them, you know, collectively. And Joan, thank you for the point that you made. And I just, right across the board, we need to be saying to our elected officials, particularly the Democrats, don't be afraid. We need to be saying to them what Franklin Roosevelt said to us in 1933. You know, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. And fear itself ain't all that scary. So, Brody in Coolidge, Georgia. Hey, Brody.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Good.
Shouldn't they know that already? That we are going to support them?
They don't. They don't. I mean, these people, ever since the middle of the Clinton administration, the Democrats have been on the short end of an incredible beating. And the Republicans have played such incredible dirty pool. I mean, was it yesterday, the day before, on Chris Matthews, they had some right-wing whack job on there who was talking with the guy who was the founder of VoteVets.org and called him un-American and said that he was stabbing Americans in the back. Can you imagine if a liberal said that to a conservative? It would be, you know, you traitor, you're spitting on the graves of the founders, you know, you're stabbing our soldiers in the back. If a liberal said that to a conservative, America would freeze up. And yet conservatives are still using this kind of language on a regular basis. Yeah, no, the Congress is feeling very, very battered, frankly. I mean, there's still been no serious investigation, at least that I can tell, about, for example, the anthrax attack where there was an attempted assassination of two Democratic members of the U.S. Senate.
Well, that's what I called in to preface there. That was my actual point of the call, you know, 3 hours ago. But Ellen Ratner, in her statement talking to you, was saying that Congress has the right to investigate things like that. And now
yes.
We have a Congress that should be doing something.
Yes.
Why aren't they investigating it?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know. I just don't know. And in fact, call in tomorrow and remind me. We'll ask Bernie if he has any insights into that. But frankly, I think that the investigation into anthrax was handed over to the Justice Department way back when. And so it's Alberto Gonzalez's job to investigate it. I mean, this is a serious crime, an attempted assassination of members of the United States Senate. It's a serious crime. And somehow the Justice Department just doesn't seem to be able to find, fill in the obscene metaphor of your choice right there. Norma in Long Beach, California. Hey, Norma.
Hi, my favorite intelligent and informative person.
Thank you.
What I'm concerned about is that Privacy Act, and I know everybody's saying, oh, they're going to spy on our candidates and so forth. What about the Republicans? How many Republicans are going to be listened into to find out whether they're going against Bush, whether they're, you know, just what their plans are in the future?
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that in Franco's Spain, in Mussolini's Italy, and in Hitler's Germany, the people within the party were as terrified. And for that matter, you know, in the Kremlin, I mean, there's that great story I've told a number of times, and Norma, thank you for the call, of Khrushchev. When he was speaking before the Politburo and he started criticizing Stalin, and somebody in the back said, why didn't you criticize Stalin when you were sitting here in the Politburo? And Khrushchev says, who said that? And there's just total silence. He says, who said that? Total silence. Nobody's even breathing now. He pounds his fist on the lectern. Who said that? Nobody answers. And he smiles and he looks out at all the guys at the Politburo and he says, now you know why I didn't speak up when I was sitting where you're sitting. And that's what's happening. And we have to be the ones to tell our elected officials, be brave. Because, you know, a lot of them are, frankly. Again, the majority of Democrats voted against this FISA legislation. But the ones who didn't vote against it, we need to tell them, don't be afraid. We're here with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Nice if we were all really free. You know, like we knew that if we got sick, we wouldn't have to worry about health care, or if we lost our jobs, we wouldn't have to worry about the income until we find another one. If we could go to college for free in the United States, and like you can in virtually every other developed country in the world, and get a degree and not be totally a slave to debt, wouldn't that be nice? Anyway, time for our best of the rest of the news segment every Thursday afternoon. We get on a couple of folks from out there in the internets, in the blogosphere, and life in the hits tubes, not trucks, you know. Today, Thomas Hefner is with us from economyincrisis.org, one of my favorite websites. It's just a remarkable, incisive, insightful look at what's going on with our economy, particularly with the selling off of America. Thomas Hefner, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom.
And also joining Thomas is going to be Eric Bollert. Eric is with MediaMatters.org, and he's also the author of a book, Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush, and has also worked as a senior writer for Salon.com and Rolling Stone magazine, now with MediaMatters.com. Eric, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. Eric, let me start with you. What do you see as the top stories of the week? What's at the top of your radar screen over at Media Matters?
Well, I've been paying a lot of attention to the Murdoch purchase of the Wall Street Journal, and which went through last week, the $5 billion deal. I wrote this week about, you know, what they agreed to sort of set up this special committee that was going to sort of protect the Wall Street Journal from Rupert Murdoch, who has a reputation for meddling and using his news outlets for political purposes. So
didn't the London Times try something like that?
Well, that's a good point. And afterwards, people reported that Murdoch didn't take it seriously at all. And they set up this blue ribbon panel, and it was, it didn't do anything. Well, within, 48 hours of the creation of the special committee and the journal, it was found out that one of the members runs a foundation that has received $2.5 million from Murdoch's News Corp, which is unusual since one of the stipulations for the members is that they were to be completely independent, have no relationship with Murdoch or News Corp. And the second is the committee is going to be chaired by, a very conservative right-wing columnist, who is just sort of, for a living, just sort of tosses out Republican talking points, anti-labor, anti-union. Was wrong about Iraq, and he's going to be charged with protecting the Wall Street Journal's integrity.
And the Wall Street Journal is one of the organs, one of the institutions, the journalistic institutions that's done actually a very good job over the last few years of documenting the economic and potentially political threat of China to us, and yet Rupert Murdoch is the largest purveyor of satellite television in China, and he cut a deal with the Chinese government.
One of the most famous incidents was when he was trying to get his satellite business in China. He pulled the BBC because the Chinese government didn't like the BBC, and he did some other things that were clearly sort of kowtowing to the Chinese government and putting political and corporate interests ahead of journalism, and which is why everyone at the Wall Street Journal is so nervous. And so here they are, they create this committee. And it turns out to be total window dressing, and more importantly, Murdoch doesn't care who knows it, because all you have to do is look at those conflicts of interest, and you come to the conclusion that it's not a serious undertaking. Although, all the members who sit on the committee, who are completely independent of Murdoch and News Corp, will meet four times a year, and they'll be paid $100,000 each.
Yeah, so useful idiots, but well-paid useful idiots.
Something like
that. Yeah, interesting. Thomas Hefner over at economyincrisis.org. What are the main stories that you guys are looking at?
Right now the feature story we have on our website is Uncle Sam, Your Banker Will See You Now. It says, early this morning, China let the idiots in Washington and Wall Street know that it is them by the short hairs. Two senior spokesmen for the Chinese government observed that China's considerable holding of U.S. dollars and treasury bonds contributes a great deal to maintaining the position of the dollar as a reserve currency.
Yeah, we did that story yesterday, I believe, or the day before here on the program, and it's a shocker.
That's really a shocker.
Yeah, you had the two, one guy who's an official of the government, another who's a major official with a think tank, and in China they use think tanks to put out the government pronouncements because think tanks can't exist without government approval.
Right.
One of them actually referring to China selling off our debt, our treasuries, as the nuclear option.
Right, that's another article they have, the nuclear option. You're right. That's extremely ominous. But the whole point of our website is to make people aware of what's happening. Most people think things are great, because our GDP is up all the time. But that's a counterinformative statistic that we're being misled by, because 70% of the GDP is consumer spending. So the higher our GDP goes up, the higher our balance of trade deficit goes up, because nothing is made in the United States anymore to any extent that people are buying.
Right, and what this means is that we have to borrow money from other countries all over the world to buy all this stuff, and now they're sitting on all of our money, or now it's their money, and our debt, and they can use this against us as a weapon.
Right. Well, like I say, the whole point of our is to make people aware that we're importing more than we need and can afford. We're producing less in American-owned factories and selling out. We've sold out. People can't imagine the consequences of this. Selling in the last, since 1978, we've sold 14,449 of our best companies to foreigners. The future profit goes to these companies. The technology resides with these companies. And there's very, very little labor jobs that are available to us because most of these companies that manufacture that are owned by foreigners, they assemble imported components.
Right.
So the amount of output in relation to the labor content is very, very little. They're very, very efficient. But that it's not a feather in our cap, even though they're registered as American registered corporations. So it looks great for us, but it's really terrible.
Right.
Losing ownership and control of our country and fooling ourselves with the GDP is up all the time.
Yep. Well said. And in fact, economyandcrisis.org is just right at the top of my my list of great economic websites. Eric Bollard over at MediaMatters.org, you guys are doing a fabulous job also of essentially outing the nonsense and BS coming out of both the mainstream media and the right wing. What do you see, Eric, as the stuff on the horizon that we might not be noticing, but that's going to be the big stories days?
Well, I think the campaign, and just a quick point, and to tie these two points together, what Tom was saying, the Wall Street Journal, I mean, that's why everything he talked about is why it's so important for the Wall Street Journal to remain independent. I mean, it's a great newspaper. It could do better. I don't think it's been as forthright on sort of the coming crisis in the news pages. I think it's still sort of pulling its, you know, establishment punches.
I think they're afraid of precipitating a crisis.
But it's so important in the coming months and years to have, you know, an absolutely aggressive, independent, you know, news operation focusing on Wall Street and the economy. And we can't really afford, it's too important to leave it to Rupert Murdoch. I mean, that's sort of the bottom line. On the horizon, I guess we spent a lot of time focusing on the campaign and the media coverage. You know, for Democrats who went through the Al Gore debacle with inventing the internet and then the Swift Boat debacle with John Kerry, you know, progressives really want to keep their eyes and ears open and sort of knock down when the press starts sort of, you know, regurgitating the Republican talking points. So, you know, unfortunately we saw, you know, what was the summer of 2007? You know, it was haircuts and cleavage. I mean, and that's what the campaign coverage, too much of it was about John Edwards' haircut and what kind of blouses this, you know, the senior senator from New York is wearing. It's discouraging, but we're sort of committed to stay on top of it and to not let things sort of jump the tracks like they have in the previous campaign seasons.
Yeah, and you're doing a great job, and David has put together a marvelous organization there. Thomas Hefner, what do you see over at economyandcrisis.org on the horizon? Are there any things that any little flags that are sticking up that you think are going to become, you know, large ships when they get closer to us?
Well, you know, we're living in a frog syndrome. You know, I don't know if you know what a frog syndrome is. I mean, the giant Chinese and the Japanese are loaning us all the money we want. We owe Japan $650 billion. We owe China $350 billion. And they don't want us to produce anything. So we're very, very comfortable living in debt at every level. A frog syndrome is if you put a frog in warm water, it feels very comfortable. And you heat it up, it doesn't jump out until it's scalded to death. And that's what's happening to us. We can't compete with Chinese wage rates at 35 cents an hour, and we can't compete with Japanese technology. We just can't compete, but we're still living very, very well on our accumulated wealth and in debt.
The debt bomb that really is the danger, isn't it? I mean, this is why you're seeing the stock market's down 283 points right now. And the headline in the New York Times, stocks tumble as home loan worries spread. This is the microcosm of the macrocosm. Individual home mortgage debt is a reflection of massive national debt.
Absolutely. our home mortgages from 87 has gone from $1.8 trillion to $8.2 trillion. Our consumer debt from $2.7 trillion to $11 trillion. Our government debt is approaching $9 trillion, and we pay approximately 5% interest on that. So our interest charges alone on government $9 trillion debt is $405 billion. It's $1.1 billion a day, just debt charges.
Yeah.
While we were producing less and living just as good.
So the what you're talking about is maybe a collapse, maybe at the very least a crunch, shall we say.
As we accumulate more and more debt.
Yeah. Now, Eric, Thomas, thank you for your point. We got to wrap it up. Thomas Hefner, economyandcrisis.org, Eric Bollert with MediaMatters.org. Thanks to both of you for being with us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
If it came along, everyone that knew him knew which side that he'd be on. He never was a hero for this county's shining light, but you could always find him standing up for what he thought was right. He'd say, "You've got to stand for something, or you'll fall for anything. You've got to be your own man, not a puppet on a string. Never compromise what's right and uphold your family name. You've got to stand for something, or you'll fall for anything."
Indeed, this is why we need to be telling those Democrats, those 16 Democrats in the Senate and the 41 in the House, if they happen to be your elected representatives who voted for this FISA bill, that in the future, you know, I disagree with your vote now, and please know, in the future, we will do everything we can to support you if you will stand up to these people, please. Interesting story up at the top of Huffington Post. George W. Bush treated for Lyme disease, failed to disclose it for nearly a year. One of the symptoms of Lyme disease, problems with concentration and short-term memory. Apparently, he had the characteristic bullseye rash that comes along with Lyme disease. Wow. Well, that would explain some things. A lot of us have been wondering, you know, what happened? Why? There's a famous video running around YouTube that you can easily probably, you know, Google or track it down on YouTube of Bush debating as governor and Bush debating as president, when he debated Kerry, and just this 10-year period of difference. And it's like night and day. As governor, he was so articulate, and he was right on top of everything. And as president, he was stumbling and faltering and falling. And maybe the spirochetes? The little bugs, the Lyme disease bugs, got to his brains. Who knows? Ted in Taggart, Oregon. Hey, Ted, what's up?
Hey, Tom. So I was calling to solicit your understanding of what the procedure is for changing the Speaker in the House of Representatives. And my question is there a procedure for doing that? And if so, how does it start, and what are the steps of the process? And if there's anybody out there that has answers to that.
Yeah, the Speaker of the House is elected by the entire House, which actually means the Speaker of the House is elected by the majority party, the members of the majority party. But the job of the Speaker is to represent the entire House, not just the Democratic Party. The job of the number two person in the House, the House Whip, is to represent the party. And so Nancy Pelosi represents all the members of the House of Representatives.
And how do we change that? How do we get her out of there and get somebody else in there?
You know, the way you'd have to do that, if that was your goal, it would be to convince. You'd have to do a literally Democratic member of Congress by Democratic member of Congress, convince them to not vote for her as Speaker during the next Congress, assuming that the Democrats continue to hold control of the House of Representatives.
Well, there's no way to take her out in midterm then.
Not practically. I mean, you know, arguably it could be done. Typically what's happened is speakers have resigned. You know, there was the speaker who resigned, I'm forgetting his name, because of the book deal thing. You know, this is the guy before Newt got his book deal. And, you know, it's happened. But see, I think that rather than attacking Nancy Pelosi or going after her and saying, hey, you're not being strong enough, what we need to be doing is we need to be saying, you're not being strong enough and we will support you, rather than you're not being strong enough and we're going to kick you.
Well, I thought that's what the election in 06 was about.
No, I don't, you know, that's one election. And it was one little moment in time, and it was a little moment in time that didn't happen to follow a new war. I mean, by the time of the 06 election, the war in Iraq was already going south. So Bush had not bombed Iran. I mean, many of us were expecting him to bomb Iran just before the 06 elections. And frankly, I think many people in his own party were expecting him to. They thought he was going to pull a rabbit out of the hat by that. But I think that there's a broad expectation that there is going to be a rabbit pulled out of the hat by the Republicans in 08. There will be an October surprise. And you know, we need to be supporting, frankly, in my opinion, the Democratic members of the House and Senate. And as much as we tell them that we disagree with particular votes, we need to say, and if you will begin to stand up, we will be here for you. And you know, they can only do what they can do with all of us behind them. There has to be enough of us. Otherwise, we just become, you know, one of these little fringe groups out on the side, you know, jumping up and down and saying, you know, we don't think there should be, you know, fill in the blank, you know, like the anti-abortion folks or whatever, and end up being marginalized. And I think that it's all about becoming or you know, participating in the process in a way that is encouraging and positive. I guess I've said it. Dick in Seattle. Hey, Dick.
Yeah, Tom, about the attack on the majority Democratic leadership with the U.S. government anthrax.
Yeah.
You didn't want to call Bush and Cheney terrorists, but, you know, if you believe the weaponized anthrax from Fort Detrick was a deliberate murder attempt or a lethal intimidation controlled by the Cheney-Rove administration to provide for the Patriot Act passage and thus facilitate the war in Iraq, you must also then consider all the evidence for their obvious involvement in the 9/11 attack. I mean, it's way past time to draw the conclusions, you know, that we have two sets of fundamentalist terrorists here, capitalist Republican fascists in the White House and religious Muslim extremists that colluded in 9/11, you know, if not in the war in Iraq itself.
Yeah. And see, that's the thing. You can't say that until we have the evidence, and that's why there needs to be the investigations. And it's why it's so critical that there be a really serious and thoughtful investigation in 9/11, and why also there be some serious multiple serious investigations of what happened with the anthrax attack. Where did that come from? Why did it only go against the two Democrats that could have stopped the Patriot Act right after the Patriot Act arrived on their desks? You know, what's the deal with that? Tomorrow, Bernie Sanders, Brunch with Bernie coming up, and Anything Goes Friday. Call in about anything. You're going to have a great day tomorrow. So thanks so much for being with us today. Remember, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there and get active. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.
Tag, you're it!